Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is the Jewish professor of Bible at the Vanderbilt Theological Seminary, Amy Jill Levine, author of the new book, Short Stories by Jesus. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mavina on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. It's extremely hard to believe that it's the month of November already and there are less than 60 days left in 2014. Somehow all the cliches about time really flying faster and faster are coming true in my life. I know that Einstein explained that time and space are actually the same thing or part of it, one continuous fabric underlying all existence. But as the time seems to trickle ever more quickly through the hourglass of life, I begin to wonder, just where did that last month go? And where has most of this year gone? Seemed to whiz by. But while time does seem to be flying by, we are now reading a part of the Torah in Temple that focuses on space rather than time. Last week's portion of Lech Lecha included the first description of the boundaries of the land of Israel. At the beginning of Judaism, God commanded Abram, later renamed Abraham, Lech Lecha el ha'aretz asher areka, go to the land that I will show you. Abram and his wife Sarai were living in the city of Haran that time. It's in Turkey today, just north of what's now the Syrian border. Abram moved his household immediately and relocated to Canaan. God announced that this is the land God would give to Abraham and his descendants forever. But while the Torah leaves the exact borders of that land unclear, the general idea is that the Hebrews, Abram and Sarai's descendants, Abraham and Sarah's children, you know, us, will inherit a country that includes the Jordan River, the Sea of Galilee, and the hill country encompassing Jerusalem, with some of the Negev Desert and a bit of the Mediterranean coast included. Different dimensions are given for this holy land in various sections of the Torah, sometimes including both the east and west bank of the Jordan River Valley, sometimes going as far west as the Nile, sometimes as far east as the Euphrates. It's a broad promise to a homeland that will be given to the descendants who are going to become as numerous as the sands of the seashore and the stars of the heavens. That homeland, with somewhat different dimensions and a similar controversy about its exact borders, is known today as Israel. So what exactly constitutes the sacred land of Israel and the divine promises given in the Torah? Well, it's not totally clear. The various boundaries do not agree. Some are larger, others more modest. No real estate title company or county assessor's office could possibly issue an unquestioned, specific deed to Eretz Yisrael based solely on the biblical record. In fact, the Bible promises given to the land of Israel are even less clear than the legal status of, say, East Jerusalem or the West Bank in today's laws. But the concept is what's there. We Jews are to inherit the land of Israel and live on it in perpetuity. But there's another aspect to this story. Virtually from the beginning, it's apparent that the land God promised to Abraham and Sarah's descendants is in a pretty tough neighborhood, and perhaps occupied already. The future Jews from the beginning will be surrounded by people who have a very different theology, follow other legal codes or none at all, and are usually quite hostile. Abraham himself has to take up arms at one point to save his nephew, and often in the Bible that pattern repeats. We Jews brought monotheism to the world, established the centrality of a moral basis for society enshrined in law and justice. But we also experienced serial attacks and persecutions at the hands of the peoples among whom we dwelled in virtually every generation. Many times we've discovered that only when we're able to defend ourselves are we able to hold on to our land, or even protect our homes and families from annihilation. So it should come as no surprise that a similar sort of state exists today. Surrounding Israel are the nations of Egypt, Jordan, Syria, and Lebanon, as well as the Palestinian Authority territories of Gaza and the West Bank. Quite close are Iraq and Iran, with Afghanistan and Libya not really that far away. All of these countries are in various states of unrest, ranging from minor conflicts to gigantic civil wars to vicious, maniacal hordes intent on beheading innocent civilians. In effect, half of the Jews alive in the world today, all of us living in Israel, live in what is still a very bad neighborhood, and one that requires great strength and vigilance to protect the people and the nation from damage. Like Abraham, Jews in Israel do well to keep faith in God, but also to be well prepared and ready to defend the only Jewish country in the world, the homeland initially promised to Abraham in the Torah last week and this week. Well, may the promise of eternal safety and peace in this holy land of Israel, whatever its precise borders, finally come true in our day. In the meantime, may we continue to support Israel as it protects our people in the very nasty neighborhood in which we have created this incredible fulfillment of the divine promise. To play us in this morning, here's a classic song about the bittersweet nature of life in Israel from the great songwriter, the late Naomi Shemer, Al Kol Ela.
Al hadvash ve'al ha'okets, al hamar ve'hamatok, al biteinu ha'tinoket, shmor eli ha'tok. Al ha'esh ha'mevo'eret, al ha'mayim ha'zakim, al ha'ish ha'shav ha'baita min ha'merchakim. Al kol ele, al kol ele, שמונה לי, יהיה לי הטוב. על הדבש ועל העוקץ, על המר והמתוק, על נטע הכל נטוע, אל תשכח את התקווה. Shiveni ve'ashuva el ha'aretz ha'tovah.
That was Tal Kravitz's version of the classic Naomi Shemer song, Al Kol Ela. You know, there are very, very few Jewish professors of Bible, including the New Testament, working at Christian seminaries in the south of America. But Amy Jill Levine is not your typical professor. Her new book, which takes the parables of Jesus in their context as Jewish stories, is also anything but typical. Learn what that means when we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish. Join the Tucson Hebrew Academy as we celebrate and honor an all-around mensch, Pima County Supervisor Ray Carroll, Sunday evening, November 2nd at the JCC. Supervisor Carroll's great contribution to THA as a board member and the work he's done as a public servant for Tucson and Pima County is an inspiration to people of all faiths and backgrounds. Ray Carroll's commitment to our community is an example of how to make the world a better place. Also at this year's Tikkun Olam event, we welcome back world-renowned comedian, author, Too Jewish radio show guest, and Jewish Day School graduate, the very funny Joel Chasnoff as MC and entertainer. In addition to this hilarious comic and our worthy honoree, Tikkun Olam offers dinner, a silent auction, and a great chance to socialize. I can tell you personally, it's one of the best and most enjoyable nights of the whole Tucson year. This is the Tucson Hebrew Academy's largest fundraiser. We'd love to have you join us. For tickets or sponsorship, call 529-3888. That's 529-3888. Or visit our website, thaaz.org.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the... at Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pasquagaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Professor Amy Jo Levine. She's the author of the new book, Short Stories by Jesus. She has the unique distinction of being a Jewish professor of New Testament and Bible at the seminary in Vanderbilt. It's really an extraordinary place. Welcome back to Two Jewish.
Delighted to be able to join you.
So, first of all, what prompted you to write Short Stories by Jesus?
Actually, a couple of prompts. On the one, I was interested in the stories. Pretty much everybody, whether Christian or not, has heard expressions like Good Samaritan and Prodigal Son. And in churches, they're frequently preached with, you know, God loves you and all that. And that's nice. But I didn't think that's what first century Jews were hearing when they heard those stories. So I wanted to get the history of those stories into the public knowledge. And the other prompt was, so many Christian interpretations of these parables have a very strong anti-Jewish basis to them, and I wanted to dig up and then get rid of that noxious accompaniment that goes with so many parable interpretations.
Why did they take on that air? You know, when you read the New Testament, it doesn't seem nearly as anti-Jewish as it seems to come out in later patristic writings and other interpretations.
Right. The majority of the problems are not in the New Testament itself. They are in later interpretations. And what happened was, as Christian readers got farther and farther away from Christianity's Jewish roots, the less they understood about early Judaism and the more likely they became to stereotype negatively Jesus' Jewish context. So that among the early church fathers, and continuing even into some preaching today, Judaism represents everything that's wrong, and Jesus represents everything that's right.
Jesus, of course, comes from the Galilee of at least one Jewish parent, depending on whether you're Christian or Jewish interpretation of it. Almost all his followers are Jews. How did we get to this place?
Because as Judaism and Christianity gradually separated, we stopped knowing each other. We started to define ourselves over against each other. And sometimes it becomes much easier to say negative things about people who think differently from us, who pray differently, who act differently, than it is to get to know our neighbors and try to be sympathetic to their particular religious worldviews.
We'll look at some of the specific stories, but, you know, for many Jews, the idea of reading the New Testament is problematic, even anathema. How do you answer that kind of comment?
Well, ignorance never helped anybody. When I first started working on New Testament studies, I had an aunt who said to me, "Why are you reading that hateful, anti-Jewish, disgusting material?" And I said to her, "Well, have you ever read it?" And she said, "No, why would I read that hateful material?" First, if we Jews want our Christian friends to be sympathetic and respectful toward us, which includes knowing about our texts and traditions, I think we ought to reciprocate and be familiar with their materials. Second, if someone does cite something from the New Testament that sounds anti-Jewish, we Jews need to know that material so we know how to respond. And third, so much of that material is Jewish material. It's stories about Jews and stories told by Jews. So looking at the New Testament is actually reclaiming some of our own history.
We will talk much more with Amy Jo Levine. Her book is called, her newest book is called Short Stories by Jesus. Engaging, interesting, and we'll hear a lot more about it when we come back on Too Jewish. Now I want to express my thanks. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm glad and grateful that the modest cash awards we started with some 10 years ago have grown into a rather substantial amount with the help of donors like many of you. The Kohan Foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan of blessed memory, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the whole Jewish people. That service can be in one of four areas: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. Our past award winners include some truly amazing people, and we are grateful for the chance to reward them and their fine work. Do you know of someone who could qualify for a Kohan Award in 2015? Or will you consider participating in this work yourself? Please go to our website, www.kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N award.com, where you can find all the information on nominating and on participating in this great work. And we'll be glad to hear from you. Our goal is to help people who work for the whole Jewish people.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome Pam and David of Freedom Smoke. So your product, a smokeless way to get off of tobacco, people don't really understand exactly what's wrong with cigarettes, or they think it's the same thing that's wrong with your product. Can you explain the difference?
That's true, Rabbi Kohan. Part of it is the cigarettes themselves, the FDA made them release the ingredients. There's over 3,000 ingredients in cigarettes. There's four ingredients in electronic cigarettes. Propylene glycol, vegetable glycerin, flavorings from Flavor Art in Italy, who is who we use, and nicotine itself. Our nicotine is USP hospital grade. It's the finest that you can purchase. Nicotine in and of itself is not harmful to the human body. That's why we have so many doctors referring patients that they just cannot get to quit smoking cigarettes. They send them to us for a much healthier alternative.
And where do people go and how do they find your stuff?
They can go to one of our three stores here in Tucson. We've got one at Orange Grove and River, one at Broadway and Swan, and one at 12th and Valencia. Or they can go online to freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thanks very much, and we'll talk next week.
Always a pleasure.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18. Or visit our website at 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, 2JewishRadio.com. Streaming us from there or downloading us at the Apple iTunes Store is very popular audio podcasts. We welcome our Mivina and Israel Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Oshrat, there's a lot in the news about the Affordable Health Care Act. Some people call it Obamacare and the changes that are coming. And I think it's finally going to be implemented in January. Many parts of it, some of it's already in existence. Americans have long thought we have the best health care in the world, but then we don't understand our own system and lots of people aren't insured. And to others, it seems like a complete mess. You're coming at it from an Israeli perspective where national health care is an article of faith. It's been there all along, and where there are more doctors per capita than anywhere in the world in Israel. Tell us a little bit about your perspective on the American health care system.
Since we also have in Israel a lot of lawyers,
yes,
so they're always changing the laws. So anyway,
you have a lot of accountants too, and they keep changing the budget and the statements, and I don't think any of it makes any sense.
So 20 years ago, healthcare was different because, you know, we were much more social.
A much more socialist economy then, right?
Before privatization,
which...
That
started some of it under Netanyahu's first prime ministership.
Yeah, so 20, 30 years ago, 20 for sure, like everyone has a free healthcare. You know, that was...
Kupat Cholim,
yeah. And it was mainly Klalit. And then we had Leumit and Meuchadet and, you know,
set up
and
other
now
kinds
there is
of programs.
Three
now
or four, three big and one or two more. And all the hospitals will be part of this. So everything will be free. Whatever you need to go, Chas v'chalila, if someone need to go to hospital, it will take like Tofes 17, one of the form from the Kupat Cholim, and he will go to hospital, and that's it.
You take a form, you don't pay any money, it's covered by all the taxes you pay to the government.
Exactly. But since then, and the privatization process, so things changed a little bit, but it's still different than here. Because part of our salary those who are working in Israel, part of their salary will go to the social security, and those who are not working and getting and get social security, benefits. It will be part of their benefit, and this will cover the basic, which is very good, healthcare. And if you want to add more, like whatever, so you pay, we will pay more. But here, as I've learned, because I have American healthcare, so you need to pay for everything,
right?
But I will ask you later, like how people that really can't afford themselves and they go into the hospital, but the hospital here are committed to take care of them. And then they, maybe that's why they charge you and me
so much more.
So much.
Yeah, part of it is the large uninsured population in America, and hospitals write off a lot of those costs. And the way they write it off is they charge the insurance companies, and then they charge those of people who can pay more. It's a very complicated system. I'm not sure it's a system at all, and it'll be interesting to see how it turns out now that there's some national approach to healthcare, which has seen as many as 40, to perhaps as much as 50% of the American population uninsured, and many people just go to the emergency room because they can't go to regular doctors, and then it gets very expensive. So it's a fascinating and complicated mess here. And in Israel, which had a reputation for bureaucracy, actually I think the healthcare system works pretty well.
Yes.
Oshrat, we'll talk next week.
Thank you.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, Islamism is all over the news, as it has been on and off since 9/11 and maybe before that. And I mean 9/11 2001, not, you know, this year. It has obviously been spoken about not only in the media, but also by rabbis from pulpits. It's a big part of how we think about the world today. And people are saying there's such a huge threat that Europe is becoming Islamist. And so what's your appraisal of the current situation? I know it's a big question and a broad one.
Well, it is a very broad question, and we could talk for many hours about it. But the first thing I have to say is that on a lot of these news shows, especially where there's a panel of people, and especially if that panel includes Ben Affleck, you have a lot of people who are...
one of the really great political thinkers of our day.
They're spouting sentiments and feelings with little actual experience in or knowledge of the Islamic world. And I mean, let me just review a few basic distinctions that we've made on your show before, but that are very important. A, Muslims and Arabs are not synonymous. Many Arabs are not Muslims. They can be Christians, Jews, they can be anything else, but they're not all Muslims. And the vast majority of Muslims are not Arabs. They are Indians or Pakistanis or Bangladeshis.
Indonesians,
right,
and so on.
Right, exactly. So Muslims refers to a religious group, and Arabs refers to a linguistic group. People who call God Allah because Arabic is their mother tongue or the mother tongue of their parents or their grandparents or whatever. Not a religious group. So to all the people who use interchangeably the words Muslim and Arab, I would beg of you, please stop and choose your words more carefully. That's A. B, neither all Muslims nor all Arabs are automatically terrorists or intolerant or narrow-minded or extremist. Almost by definition, every large group of people, and there are like 1.5 billion Muslims in the world or 1.3 billion or whatever, but over a billion. So within a group of people that large, there will be almost inevitably some extremists and some bad apples and some people who are prone to violence and whatever. I don't think we can conclude necessarily that because so much violence and terrorism in the world this year or this decade seems to come from Islamist groups, that Islam is a more dangerous religion than any other. I mean, if you look back at history, at various points in time, other religions have been equally dangerous, equally violent, and equally aggressive. So fair is fair, which is not to say that there's no threat today. In some senses, certain elements of the Islamic world want to redress the wrongs they suffered during the Crusades. There are even people who want to recapture the lost provinces, like Andalusia in Spain, for example. Right.
Right.
So clearly there are some Muslims, not necessarily Arabs, who want to reverse the course of history or get even for historic wrongs where they feel like the Christian West has wronged them. And politics, economics, lots of other things play a role in this. And the way to address it or combat it or respond to it is not necessarily through military means, and certainly not exclusively through military means. And I think we should leave it on that note and maybe continue this discussion when we have more time.
It's a longer discussion, an interesting one. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
When we come back on To Jewish in a Moment, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
Hi, I'm Ben. Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can help provide a Jewish education to families at no cost to you by redirecting your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization. You can help make Jewish education affordable.
Here's how it works. Arizona lets taxpayers receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to JETCO. This lets JETCO give scholarships to kids who attend private schools like Congregation Anshe Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, serving students from K through 8. Tax credits are different from a tax deduction or donation. When you give to JETCO, you get 100% tax credit. That means your Arizona state income taxes are reduced by the exact amount you've given. Supporters of JETCO can give up to $1,053 for a single filer or $2,106 for a married couple filing jointly and get that whole amount back from state income tax.
Give JETCO a call at 647-8442. That's 647-8442. Or you can go to JETCO.org.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Yitzchak wasn't the kind of person you would expect sympathy from. Whenever something bad happened to anybody, he always shrugged his shoulders and said, "Well, look at the bright side. It could have been worse." One day, something awful happened to the married couple living next door to Yitzchak. The husband came home early from work, caught his wife in bed with another man, shot his wife and her lover, and then killed himself. Crowds began to gather in the street. Many were in a state of horrified shock at the carnage. But as usual, Yitzchak just shrugged his shoulders and said, "Well, look at the bright side. It could have been worse." People recoiled in horror. "Don't be so stupid," they said. "How on earth could it have been worse?" And Yitzchak replied, "Well, if the husband came home early yesterday, I would be dead now." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Vayera, which includes the great and terrible story of the binding of Isaac, the Akedah. God tests Abraham by having him almost but not quite sacrifice Isaac on a rock. It's a famous section, read also on the first day of Rosh Hashanah by Reform Jews and on the second day by Conservative and Orthodox Jews. The connection to Rosh Hashanah appears to be nothing more than the fact that the ram that appears at the very end of the story is caught in a thicket by its horns, therefore is sacrificed and becomes the model for all future shofars. This section is famous for being read also on the first day of Rosh Hashanah by Reform Jews, on the second day by Conservative and Orthodox Jews, but its connection to Rosh Hashanah seems to be that the ram that appears at the very end of the story is caught in a thicket by its horns, sacrificed in place of Isaac, and becomes the model for all future shofars. Anyway, this passage, taken from the portion of Vayera, is much more than a mere animal story. Cryptic, yet oddly repetitive, it raises a host of painful moral dilemmas. It challenges us to think intensely about just what our relationship to God truly is. According to the text, God tests Abraham, Adonai Nisah et Avram, by commanding him to sacrifice his son, his only son, his beloved son Isaac. This triple identification of Isaac mirrors an earlier command in the Torah portion of Lech Lecha, which tells Abraham to begin his great journey towards God. Leave your land, leave your birthplace, leave your father's home. Now, Abraham is being told to kill his son, his only son, his beloved son. Well, there are problems in this text. First of all, Abraham has another, older son, Ishmael. Isaac is not truly his only son. Next, Isaac is actually the son of his old age with his wife Sarah. Isaac is Sarah's only son. Clearly, all God has to say is, take your son Isaac, and there'll be no doubt who is intended for the sacrificial altar. Why the extra language? Very messy. But the biggest problem with this text is the simple fact that Abraham, who has previously shown a tendency to argue and fight injustice, obeys this terrible command and does so with apparent relish. He doesn't make a peep, doesn't say a single word of objection to God. In fact, he gets up especially early in the morning in order to fulfill this horrible command of God with exceptional energy. The narrative itself sets up the drama beautifully, painfully, and tragically. Isaac, who doesn't know what's being set up, goes along with his father. The phrase, "the two walked on together," Vayelchu Shnehem Yachdav, is repeated. Isaac asks, "Where's the lamb for the burnt offering?" And Abraham replies correctly, but ironically, "God will provide." It's a weird and troubling scene. And then as Abraham is about to slaughter his own son, suddenly an angel of God intervenes. The murder of the innocent, the sacrifice of Isaac, is stopped. Isaac lives, and the future of our people, Abraham's children, is thus preserved. This story in its place and time was undoubtedly a polemical tale designed to teach the prohibition of human sacrifice. In the end, children are not meant to be slaughtered on the altar of their parents' beliefs. God does not want the blood of a human lamb. Our Lord does not truly desire the destruction of his own children. In fact, God desires life. Other religions have carried this Akedah story to a different, bloodier, more horrible conclusion, believing that human sacrifice and suffering are essential elements in a religious life. But the story of the binding of Isaac makes it clear that killing our kids and the glorification of the loss of a child will never be acceptable to Jews. In fact, Abraham's urgent rush to fulfill God's weird and terrible command to kill his son reminds us that we also can embrace morally bad decisions with great fervor. And many, many times in human history, we have sent our children off to die for causes that were not right. The great World War I poet Wilfred Owen paraphrased this theme in his piece, The Parable of the Old Man and the Young. So Abram rose and clave the wood and went and took the fire with him and a knife as they sojourned, both of them together. Isaac, the firstborn, spake and said, My father, behold the preparations, fire and iron, but where the lamb for this burnt offering? Then Abram bound the youth with belts and straps and builded parapets and trenches there and stretched forth the knife to slay his son when lo, an angel called him out of heaven, saying, Lay not thy hand upon the lad, neither do anything to him, thy son. Behold, caught in a thicket by its horns, a ram. Offer the ram of pride instead. But the old man would not do so, but slew his son, and half the seed of Europe, one by one. That was Wilfred Owen's great poem about this Binding of Isaac story. You know, we still engage in such choices, and like Abraham, we still often fail the test. May we learn from this Akedah of Abraham's to choose life and not sacrifice for our own children. We Jews rarely examine the New Testament as a Jewish book, and of course Christians don't do that much either. But you can make a strong case that the Christian Bible and its leading figure Jesus come from purely Jewish roots. That's how our guest this morning, the outstanding academic and engaging author Amy Jill Levine, sees it, and we'll hear much more from her on that subject and about her new book on Jesus' parables when we return in a few moments here on Too Jewish.
If you like fun and games, you'll love this. And this. And even this. Casino del Sol Resort offers more fun under the sun with the newest slots, the best entertainment, and world-class golf. If you want fun, hit the... At Casino del Sol Resort in Tucson. Take I-10 East to I-19 exit Valencia West or visit CasinoDelSolResort.com.
Well, they're out there having fun in that warm Arizona sun.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace. But sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Presidents of Poland and Israel joined Holocaust survivors and international representatives and officially opened the core exhibit of the Poland Museum of the History of Polish Jews last week. It is not a museum of the Holocaust, it is a museum of life, said Israel's president Reuven Rivlin at the official opening ceremony of the more than $100 million museum in Warsaw. The museum is housed in a glass-walled building that was inaugurated last year. It stands on the site of the World War II Warsaw Ghetto. The museum faces the monument to the ghetto heroes erected in 1948 atop the rubble left when the Nazis crushed the 1943 Jewish ghetto uprising. Rivlin was making his first foreign trip since his election this summer. He and Polish President Bronislaw Komorowski laid wreaths on the monument at the start of the ceremony. Komorowski, like Rivlin, said the museum offered hope for the future. It is truly special to take part in the making of history, and we are not just connecting with a centuries-long Polish-Jewish relationship, but also providing a stimulus for the future of Polish-Jewish and Polish-Israeli relations, he said. The museum was built as a public-private institution. The Polish government and the city of Warsaw provided $60 million for construction. More than 500 private and institutional donors, many Jewish, contributed the remaining $48 million for the core exhibit itself. The core exhibit uses state-of-the-art technology and installations to narrate the 1,000 years of Polish-Jewish history from the early Middle Ages to now. Before the Holocaust, 3.3 million Jews lived in Poland. 3 million were killed in the ghettos and the Nazi death camps. Thousands of survivors fled post-war anti-Semitism, making Poland the world's largest, well, Jewish graveyard. The past 25 years have seen a revival of Jewish life, culture, and identity in Poland, but the Jewish population today is estimated at just 20,000. In other news, Rabbi Yehuda Glick, a prominent right-wing activist in Israel, was shot at point-blank range outside the Menachem Begin Heritage Center in Jerusalem last week. Glick, 50 years old, was shot in the upper body by a motorcyclist with an Arab accent during an annual event organized by the Temple Mount and Eretz Yisrael Faithful Movement. Magen David Adom emergency paramedics evacuated him to Shari Tzedek Medical Center in critical condition. Glick was operated on, was in stable condition, as we report. The event, Israel Returns to the Temple Mount, was attended by Knesset members and notable right-wing activists, among them Deputy Minister Eli Ben-Dahan, Moshe Feiglin, Miri Regev, and Haggai Ben-Artzi, members of Knesset, and Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu's brother-in-law, respectively. The shooting threatens to further heighten the tensions in Jerusalem, which has been fraught with clashes between Palestinian protesters and Israeli police. Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu held a security consultation with Interior Security Minister Yitzhak Aharonovic, Jerusalem District Police Commander Moshe Edri, and Shin Bet Chief Yotam Cohen following this shooting. He told them to give top priority to capturing the shooter and to increase security forces significantly in Jerusalem. "We all pray for Yehuda," said Netanyahu. Rabbi Glick is a central activist in the Temple Mount movements. These are kind of right-wing fringe elements, but still a symbol of the struggle for Jewish prayer on the Temple Mount, Har HaBayit. Police and the Shin Bet have often barred Glick from the Temple Mount. He has been fighting legal battles against Israeli law enforcement authorities who are trying to enforce these bans. Some of Glick's legal fights have been successful. At the conference last week, Glick presented a video filmed on the Temple Mount earlier that day that showed Palestinians trying to scare Jewish visitors away with Allahu Akbar calls. "This is the situation in Jerusalem today," he said. Glick's life has been threatened repeatedly in the past. In recent days, Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, has called for a ban on Jews being allowed to go up on the Temple Mount at all, called the sacred precinct by Arabs their third most holy site, although perhaps the Jews' holiest. "In the interest of full disclosure, I was on Har HaBayit, the Temple Mount, with my own Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage group in June of this year. It was peaceful and overall very pleasant. Not so much right now."
"I came here to tell you that something is coming that is out of my control."
Having annihilated the Noah story in the washed-up movie featuring Russell Crowe earlier this year, they are now making a new film about Moses, and the star is a guy named Christian. I am not making this up. The new movie is being directed by Ridley Scott, who made Alien, Blade Runner, Gladiator, and many others, and it is called Exodus of Gods and Kings. Film stars Christian Bale, who has played Batman, won an Oscar, and recently starred in American Hustle. Speaking at a press conference in L.A., Christian Bale said that he had done research for the role of Moses by reading the Torah, the Quran, and Jonathan Kirsch's biography of Moses. And then he said, "I think the man was likely schizophrenic and was one of the most barbaric individuals I ever read about in my life." "He was very troubled, a tumultuous man and mercurial, but the biggest surprise was the nature of God. God was equally very mercurial." Bale's controversial comments have not been well received by Christian writers and bloggers, who fear the film is tampering too much with the biblical text. Influential Christian writer Brian Gottawa, who leaked elements of the Noah script online before the movie was finished, didn't help any, weighed in on Bale's comments. "Yes, Moses murdered a man and he had the character arc that went from being adopted and raised as a pagan Egyptian to a conversion to his troubled and tumultuous faith. But schizophrenic? Barbaric? Really?" And I might also add, what Moses did is called manslaughter, not murder, but oh well.
"I want Moses and his family dead."
Okay, maybe nobody wants to actually kill Christian Bale for saying those kind of crazy things about Moses, but we certainly hope the film is much better than any previous effort at depicting this fantastic tale. Remember, Christian Bale is just an actor.
"Follow me and you will be free!"
Perhaps if we watch the coming Exodus movie, we too will achieve freedom. It debuts in time for Hanukkah. Shouldn't it come out in time for Pesach? Anyway, that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Professor Amy Jo Levine is a University Professor of New Testament and Jewish Studies, the E. Rhodes and Leona B. Carpenter Professor of New Testament Studies and Professor of Jewish Studies at Vanderbilt Divinity School and the College of Arts and Science in Nashville, Tennessee, and has lots of other affiliations, including at Cambridge. You have described yourself as a Yankee Jewish feminist teaching at a Christian divinity school in the buckle of the Bible Belt. That's first of all, that's quite a self-description. Accurate?
Yeah, absolutely accurate. I'm also a member of an Orthodox shul, although I'm not particularly Orthodox in practice.
How does that happen?
Speaking as a Reform rabbi, in the interest of full disclosure.
PhD in New Testament. I'm a trained historian, so I'm qualified to teach this material. I'm also sympathetic to both Jewish and Christian readings. I think with religion, unlike elementary school arithmetic, you can come to mutually exclusive explanations of a text, and you can both be right. In a sense, this is very Jewish. The rabbis tell us that there are 70 different faces to the Torah. We can come up with mutually exclusive interpretations, and we've been doing that over the centuries. So when I look at Christian materials, I'm inclined to say, how would these stories have been understood in their original Jewish context? How did they get understood over time? And for those people who hold these texts sacred, whether the Gospel of John or the letters of Paul, how can they be responsibly taught today so that the teaching does not inculcate any sort of anti-Jewish bias?
So let's get right into it. One of the most, well, first of all, Jesus' parables are not nearly as clear as many people think they are.
Oh, not at all.
I've heard them described as the least transparent of any part of the Bible. I don't know if you'd agree with that, but let's take one of the really hard ones, the short parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. Can you unpack that for us a little bit?
Sure. It shows up in the Gospel of Luke chapter 18, and it's simple. Two fellows go up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and one a tax collector. And the Pharisee is standing by himself, and he's saying, God, I thank you that I am not like other people, rogues or sinners or adulterers or even like that, their tax collector. I fast twice a week. I tithe. I give a tenth of everything that I obtain. But the tax collector, standing at a distance, would not even look up to heaven, but he was beating his breast, and he was saying, be merciful to me, O God, a sinner. And already we have problems here, because the Christian, having gone through several chapters of the Gospel of Luke, is inclined to think the Pharisee is sanctimonious and hypocritical and lying and terrible and conceited. And the tax collector is just absolutely darling because he's repentant. Why? Because Luke has given us a text filled with quite nasty Pharisees and quite darling tax collectors. The problem is that in the first century, for Jews, Pharisees were honored. They were known not only for talking the talk, but also walking the walk. They were known for teaching the people. And tax collectors were folks who decided to work for the Roman occupation government and take money from Jews and give it to Rome. So already, because of the parable's placement in the Gospel of Luke, Christian readers are likely to assess the parable differently than first century readers. And more, normally people translate the last line of the parable to say, and therefore the tax collector went down to his house justified in a right relationship with God, rather than the Pharisee. But the Greek could actually be translated alongside the Pharisee, because first century Jews had a very broad definition of divine mercy, and they weren't inclined to play this either-or game. But as the centuries go by, the Pharisee is the one who's dismissed, and the tax collector is looked at as just perfect.
Let's talk about the Good Samaritan. You know, it's an interesting parable, and it's interesting because you've got a non-Jew, right? The Samaritan population, which was maybe the earliest evidence we have of ethnic cleansing, where Assyrians were kind of imported into Israel while the 10 lost tribes were pulled out, but close to Jews in many of their practices. Explain what does that parable mean?
The parable is basically about a wounded fellow on the side of the road, and a priest, I mean, in Hebrew this would be a Kohen, walks by, and then a Levite walks by. And countless commentators come in and say, oh, the reason the priest and Levite walk by is because they're following Jewish law about avoiding corpses, which is just completely nonsense. First of all, the guy on the side of the road isn't dead. And second of all, there's absolutely nothing preventing a Levite from dealing with a corpse.
No, it's only a Kohen who can't.
Yeah, it's only a Kohen. But even there, with Judaism, there are certain laws that are more important than other laws, and saving a life pretty much trumps all of them. So that by the time we get up to Mishnaic and Talmudic literature, even a high priest or a Nazirite must attend a corpse that's that's left by the side of the road. But commentators who know nothing about Judaism but presume that purity laws are absolutely terrible simply import their negative stereotypes about Judaism into the parable. And then the Samaritan comes by, and he has compassion on the guy in the ditch, and he takes care of him and takes him to an inn and writes the innkeeper basically a blank check and says, you take care of him and I'll come back and I'll pay you whatever I owe you. Christian interpreters frequently, not all, not because, I don't think because they're anti-Jewish, but because they're ignorant about early Judaism, come in and explain that the parable is against Jewish purity laws or the parable is against the Jewish temple hierarchy. But that's not what first century Jews are listening to, because they're practicing those purity laws, and they find those laws a means by which they can express their Jewish identity and sanctify the body and follow Torah. What we have to learn is what Samaritans were in the first century. In the first century, Jews and Samaritans were enemies. We might think about Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland during the Troubles, or Yankee and Red Sox fans, but I mean real enemies. So from the perspective of the fellow in the ditch, he might be thinking, I'd rather die than acknowledge that this Samaritan is helping me. And then we can start looking at the parable as how do we understand life? How do we understand neighbor? How do we understand humanity? The scriptures of Israel tell us that everybody is in the image and likeness of God. And that means we have to be able to see that image and likeness not only in the people we love, but also in the people we'd be inclined to hate. And this is a tough lesson. That means I have to see the image of God in the face of Hitler, or in the face of Osama bin Laden, or for a first century Jew, in the face of a Samaritan.
You know, it's a fascinating and complicated thing to read something in the original context when you don't come from that context. Are these parables still relevant today, read through a first century lens? Are they more relevant?
I think they're more relevant. Jesus has been substantially domesticated. people have been talking about him for 2,000 years, and most people have put him into nice little boxes where he confirms what they already believe. And he's no longer used to challenge. But Jews in the first century knew that parables were not designed as banal statements of the obvious. They were designed to challenge and to provoke and to shake up the status quo and basically to tell us what deep down inside we really already know but simply don't want to admit. It's a very Jewish way of teaching. And what makes them even more interesting is that they're actually kind of funny. So here we have good Jewish teaching. You tell a story that's designed to provoke, but you throw in a little bit of humor and a little bit of irony, and people smile even while they feel uncomfortable, and then the story can go to work on us.
I want to thank Amy J. Levine for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Her book is called Short Stories by Jesus, which is available where all books are bought at Amazon. Where can people go to find out more about your work?
They can go to the Vanderbilt University Divinity School website and look me up. And I suspect I'm pretty much all over the internet.
You are indeed. Thanks so much. And good luck with the book. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 a.m. Our guest will be violinist Vadim Gluzban. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish is from the Budapest Klezmer Orchestra. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of peace.